This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
The cost of crude spurts back up.
Does that make higher pump prices inevitable?
From APM, American Public Media in Los Angeles. Hello, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm Bob Moon in for Steve Chiotakis. Good day to you. You're listening to the Midday Update from Marketplace.org. It's Thursday, the 9th of June.
Coming up, some industry followers are calling it the worst OPEC meeting ever, and it seems all but certain to mean higher energy costs for all of us.
Also, have the all-powerful banks lost the upper hand on Capitol Hill? They've been overpowered by another big industry lobby, and once again, consumers may pay a price.
And speaking of banks, Bob, a stern letter from Bank of America: pay nothing or else.
It's all ahead on the Marketplace Midday Update.
Balance your life with dollar signs. Tune into Marketplace Money this weekend for a look at the issues affecting your wallet. Whether it's investing, renting an apartment, or sending your kid off to college, we'll help you navigate.
If you're interested in buying a barrel of crude this morning, it'll set you back more than $101 on the New York market. The price is about a dollar higher in the past day, mostly the result of a chaotic OPEC meeting in Vienna. The oil cartel rejected international calls to pump more oil, and in fact, the summit ended so badly, some called it the worst OPEC meeting ever.
It's not good news for consumers. Joining us from London is Marketplace's Stephen Beard. Good day, Stephen. Are prices at the pump likely to head back up now?
Oh, absolutely. It's reckoned for every $1 increase in the price of a barrel of oil, that'll mean an extra 2.5 cents a gallon at the pumps. And it's worth noting, Bob, most of the recessions in the West were largely triggered by a sharp rise in the price of crude.
You know, after the meeting, though, Stephen, Saudi Arabia actually announced they'd pump their own oil and boost production. In theory, that should lower prices, yes?
Yes, but there's an interesting point here from Philip Verliger, a veteran oil industry watcher. He says the Saudis are playing a double game. Under pressure from the U.S., they go to the OPEC meeting, they call for an increase in output, but they cut the discounts that refineries get when they buy Saudi oil. So Philip Verliger says, yes, they're happy to pump more oil, but at a higher price.
They're not in the business of providing oil cheaply to the United States or to any other consumers. They're in the same business as you and I are in trying to maximize our wealth.
And he says the Saudis have brilliantly managed the price of oil since March 1999, when it was just $10 a barrel.
Marketplace's Stephen Beard in London. See if you can find us some better news next time, huh?
Okay, Bob.
We mentioned on yesterday's Midday Update that a vote was about to happen in the U.S. Senate involving the fees that retailers pay banks every time you use your debit card. Well, the new Dodd-Frank financial reform law puts a cap on those fees. The banks didn't like that. And yesterday's vote would have at least temporarily meant no cap. But the banks lost that battle, and some are wondering if that means they'll lose other fights over new rules in the Dodd-Frank law. Karen Petru is with us from Federal Financial Analytics in Washington. Good morning.
Morning, Jeremy.
Well, Karen, have the banks lost their sway in Washington after this vote?
No, I don't think so. And no one should win all the time, and banks never did, and they won't, and that's fine. You know, sometimes they should win, sometimes they should lose, and I think the question is which. But, you know, they're not the omnipotent force sometimes portrayed in particularly the more, you know, evil-minded view of the industry.
Well, right now there are a lot of rules that are part of the new financial reform law that are being worked out by the regulators. What kinds of things are at stake for the banking industry and for consumers in the coming months?
It's going to be a whole new game. What's at stake for both is a redefined strategic landscape for banking in the United States. And that's true not only for consumers day in, day out with their checking accounts, but also for corporations as new capital rules and other requirements required by the Dodd-Frank Act and global regulators come into play.
Karen Petru, Managing Director of Federal Financial Analytics, thanks so much for your time this morning.
Thank you, Jeremy.
For more analysis on this, let's talk to Greg McBride at Bankrate.com. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So I know you usually cover consumer issues, but it seems to me this is one of the biggest consumer angles, and that is, how powerful does this tell us the bank lobby really is?
Well, the banks were going up against a pretty powerful foe in the form of the merchants. Merchants had spent a lot of money lobbying for this change because it works to reduce their costs.
So where does this leave us? What's next? I know that the Federal Reserve will now be deciding this cap. Where is it going to go, do you think?
All signs seem to point toward this taking effect in July as scheduled. Look, the consumer is going to get stuck with the bill on this. We're already seeing that when you see things like decline in the availability of free checking, the debit rewards programs being scaled back or being eliminated altogether. So this could easily be a $200 or $250 swing for some households.
Hold on, though. The merchants were selling this to us as this being a hidden tax and it's going to save us money?
Well, we'll see. Let me ask this. I mean, would merchants have spent millions of dollars lobbying for the change if they intended to pass along every nickel in savings to the consumer? No way. You know, let's put it this way. There weren't a whole lot of merchants that were offering lower prices for cash transactions before this. So, you know, the idea that they're going to suddenly be able to lower prices across the board because of this, the jury's still out.
Greg McBride at Bankrate.com. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
The latest weekly unemployment claims are up only slightly higher than the previous week by about 1,000 newly jobless Americans seeking benefits, but that still means they're stuck at a frustratingly high level. Meantime, the stock market has now closed down every day for a week. That's the longest losing streak the S&P 500 has seen in 2 years. Diane Swonk is off this morning, but her deputy chief economist at Mesirow Financial, Adolfo Laurenti, joins us now from New York. Good morning.
Good morning, Jeremy.
Well, Adolfo, stocks are sort of mixed this morning, but the S&P 500 has been down the last several days, longest losing streak since 2009. Do you think that should concern ordinary people, or is this just investors being investors?
Well, unfortunately, economic activity has slowed down in recent weeks. We believe it's a variety of temporary factors, but they are having a very broad-based impact. Think of the earthquake in Japan, the high level in the price of oil of gasoline, the bad weather. So all of this is weighing against economic performance and is reflected in the downbeat mood on financial markets.
And you mentioned oil there. We heard from OPEC yesterday that they will not pump more oil, and prices are above $100 a barrel this morning. Is that something that will keep us from getting out of the economic soft patch?
It's a factor of risk. We can probably deal with oil prices at $100, but that really increased the risk that for any additional shock, the spike might be at a much higher level. That would become a major challenge to our economic reacceleration.
All right. Well, when we talk about challenges, I saw in this morning's Wall Street Journal that China's housing bubble is now potentially about to pop. If that happens, how does it play out in the U.S.?
It's a risk factor. So actually, China does not only have the problem with the housing side, they are also having some excess over investment in industrial capacity, infrastructures. Inflation is rising over there. The major risk for the United States is that if something goes wrong in China, they may stop buying our debt, mostly our treasury notes and T-bills, and that will immediately impact our interest rates. So we are in together with the China. We really hope in a soft landing because our fiscal position does not allow any mistake on that front.
All right. Well, before we let you go, with all this doom and gloom, is there anything that you think about economically to put a smile on your face?
Well, you know, I really needed to work hard to find something, but there is something that gives me confidence. The balance sheet in corporate America is very good. I think the company have the resources to invest in new equipment, machinery, to do research and development, to hire new people. So if we can get just a break from the bad news and regain some confidence, I think we might see some good surprises in the second half of the year.
Adolfo Laurenti with Mesirow Financial, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
Don't bother stopping me if this sounds familiar. Hackers have breached online security at insert big corporation here. This time, the names, account numbers, and email addresses of hundreds of thousands of Citibank credit card customers were compromised in early May. So why are we just hearing about it now and only after a newspaper started asking questions? We put that question to Marketplace's Amy Scott.
Citigroup isn't the only company to delay notifying its customers of a security breach. When hackers stole personal data from millions of Sony PlayStation accounts, Sony waited 5 days to tell account holders. That set off a torrent of online outrage. But there are reasons companies don't rush to sound the alarm. Rick Ferguson is director of security research at Trend Micro. He says it takes time to figure out exactly which information was stolen and who was affected.
It's more helpful to minimize the disruption to your affected customers and to eliminate any concern or disruption of your unaffected customers. And you can only really do that as a result of a thorough investigation. And unfortunately, that does take time.
If you're a Citi customer, the bank says it's in the process of contacting those affected. One reassuring note, no social security numbers, card expiration dates, or those 3-digit security codes on the back of the card were stolen. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
You know, Bob, every time I get a letter from the banks, I just tear it up because it usually is a credit card offer that I don't want. But there was a guy in Northampton, Massachusetts that got a letter that was definitely worth saving. It said his home would be foreclosed on if he didn't pay up immediately.
Mm-hmm.
And the amount he owed, according to the letter,
yeah,
$0.00. Pay it now, said the bank. Well, after the local TV station WWLP did a story on this, Bank of America told the man he could stay in his home without paying $0.00. And in fact, they even sent him a $150 check for his trouble.
That's not bad.
Do you enjoy the music we play between stories? Visit the Marketplace Music section to browse playlists for all of our programs and to buy those songs on Amazon. A percentage of each purchase goes towards supporting our programs. Find more online at marketplace.org/music.
Now to the Marketplace Global Perspective, some encouraging news on the nation's trade deficit this morning. The Commerce Department reports American companies sold foreign buyers more computers, heavy machinery, and telecommunications equipment in April.
President Obama has said the future of American competitiveness depends on exports, and he wants to double sales of U.S. products abroad in the next few years. But with all that exporting, could the outsourcing of jobs follow? Marketplace's Jennifer Collins has that story.
Jared Carr's family owns Osagian Canoes in Lebanon, Missouri. Carr has always wanted to export more of the boats. The trouble was, the shipping added $500 to a $1,000 canoe.
With our canoes, you can't really fold them up. I wish I could create the one that was like the Jetsons car.
So instead of making a canoe that collapsed into that briefcase George Jetson carried to work, Carr hired a small manufacturer in Denmark to do the finishing work.
By not welding them together, we're able to stack them up in hundreds and 200s where we can actually ship them and make it cost effective for the end user.
And it puts Osagian among the ranks of the 250,000 U.S. small businesses that bring in $500 billion a year through exports.
Small businesses are the fastest-growing part of exports.
Karen Mills is the head of the Small Business Administration. Her agency, along with the Commerce Department, advises small businesses to access loans and trains them to tap into overseas markets. Osagian attended a training last year.
More exports means more American jobs.
But it may mean sending some jobs overseas. Dante DiGregorio teaches international trade at the University of New Mexico. He says there's a fine line between exporting and outsourcing.
In the process of developing export ties, most international partners want to see it in both directions.
Chile buys mining equipment from the U.S., but Chilean workers put it together. South Korea buys high-tech equipment from the U.S., but it's installed by Korean engineers. He says that kind of activity is a good thing.
Trade is a two-way street, and there can be direct benefits to the U.S. from certain outsourced activities.
Osagian hires at least two workers in Missouri for every person in Denmark. I'm Jennifer Collins for Marketplace.
Well, if you're looking for French Finance Minister Christine Lagarde today, Bob, as I know you do most mornings, you can find her on Twitter. She is on there taking questions a day before the nominations deadline in the race to run the International Monetary Fund. Now, that's a job that she wants, and it's one that has traditionally been held by a European. Developing countries say it's time to change that tradition, but as Marketplace's John Dimsdale reports, they may not get their wish this time around.
Some emerging countries are backing one of their own, Mexico's central bank governor, Agustin Carstens. But so far, Carstens doesn't have enough support, according to Fred Bergsten at the Peterson Institute for International Economics.
The truth is that the emerging market economies regard each other more as competitors and rivals than as allies in a coalition to oust the nasty Europeans or even Americans.
The top job was reserved for Europeans when the IMF was created after World War II. Mark Weisbrot at the Center for Economic and Policy Research says it's time to change.
It is symbolically rather insulting.
Still, now that European countries like Greece and Portugal are borrowing from the IMF, Europeans say it's not a good time to turn the job over to an outsider. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Food prices here in the U.S. are expected to stay high through next year. The Agriculture Department figures a wet spring will likely cut the size of this fall's corn harvest. That's expected to leave a surplus of just 695 million bushels of corn next year, less than the 900 million estimated just last month. And the floods in the Midwest aren't helping. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Adrienne Hill reports.
The rising Missouri River is threatening hundreds of thousands of acres of corn and soybeans in the Midwest. Land that
is among the most productive farmland in the country.
John Anderson is a senior economist at the American Farm Bureau Federation. He says it's too early to know the damage the water will cause, but analysts are watching this flood closely because
corn stocks are at a historically tight level.
I ask analyst Darren Newsom from Telvent DTN why the rest of us should care about corn supply. He says it's quite simple. Corn is in nearly everything food-related.
In some way, shape, or form, most everything agricultural or the food that we eat or items that we buy can be traced sooner or later back to corn.
Our soda has corn syrup, our beef eats corn, and on. So it goes like this. The bigger the flood, the tighter the corn supply. The tighter the corn supply, the higher the cost of corn. And the higher the cost of corn, the more we pay for our groceries. I'm Adrienne Hill for Marketplace.
Do you remember that Russian spy, Anna Chapman?
Mm-hmm.
This is the redhead who became the face of the Russian spy ring the FBI discovered in New York last year.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it appears she has traded in the shoe phone for a BlackBerry. She's launching a new venture capital firm to encourage entrepreneurship in Russia, as Peter Van Dyke reports now from Moscow.
When spies are uncovered, they tend to return home and quietly disappear back into the shadows. Not Anna Chapman. She's appeared in a sexy photo shoot and on the catwalk, watched a rocket launch, and joined the youth wing of the ruling United Russia Party. Now, she says she is going to help young Russian entrepreneurs find investors for high-tech startups. Ben Aris, the editor of Business New Europe, says the Kremlin is using her as a marketing tool.
She's a celebrity, and that's about the size of it. I can't see any serious venture capital investor going in with her.
But within Russia, she is taken more seriously.
Working for the KGB carries a lot more prestige, or at least different connotations to what it does in the West. And so in that sense, I think she probably has a stronger standing than she does in the West.
The Kremlin is trying everything it can think of to attract investment. If this doesn't work, the former spy still has her banking job and weekly TV show to fall back on. In Moscow, I'm Peter Van Dyke for Marketplace.
Okay, Jeremy, heads up if you're a horse racing fan.
Okay.
Do you like horse racing?
I'm not a horse racing fan,
well,
but go ahead.
A field of 12 3-year-olds has just been entered for this Saturday's Belmont Stakes. The 2-for-1 favorite is a horse named Animal Kingdom.
Hmm.
Now, wherever in the Animal Kingdom do these names come from anyway? That's what Chris Kaltenbach wondered. He's a writer for the Baltimore Sun, and he's been looking into how these famous horses get their names. Good morning. Thanks for being with us.
Good morning, Bob.
There's actually an official process for naming thoroughbreds?
There is. All proposed names have to go through the Jockey Club.
About 70% of all names that are submitted are approved, but that leaves about 30% that aren't. You can't have more than 18 letters in a name. You can't name a horse after a racetrack. So, you know, regrettably, you won't have a horse named I Love Pimlico anytime soon. You can't name a horse after a horse that's still alive. You can't name a horse after anybody who has won one of the Triple Crown races. So there are rules. And you have to be tasteful, which is the one, I guess, that people tend to run afoul of sometimes.
Now, is there anything to suggest that how they pick names has any effect on how bettors pick horses?
I don't know if there's been any studies, but you know that anybody who bets the horses is always looking for something, some hint, some lucky charm or whatever. So I suspect that there are people who look at names, and you always hear the legends of, you know, somebody who wins $1 million because they saw a horse named after their grandfather and decided to bet the house on it.
Some of these are not so great when you're a track announcer. For example, Yaka Hika Mikadola.
Yaka Hika Mikadola. That's a name that will go down in history primarily because poor Tom Durkin, when he was calling a race, just could not wrap his mouth around that name. Each time he tried to pronounce it, it became worse. And so by the end of the race, he was just Yaka Maka Lika Maka Luka. Yeah, he just didn't even try anymore. So pretty hilarious.
Any rules about this? Is there a future for corporate sponsorship of horse names, maybe like race cars?
I don't know if we have a horse named Valvoline anytime soon. I'm not sure what the Jockey Club's position is on that, but I think they would look down their nose at it.
But Yaka Hika Mikadola is just fine with them.
Yaka Hika Mikadola and Flat Fleet Feet.
Easy for you to say. Chris Kaltenbach is a reporter with the Baltimore Sun. He's been looking into how all these horses get their names. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Bob.
Okay, so Jeremy, we've pulled up the YouTube video to hear how that notorious racing call for Yaka Hika Mikadola really sounded. So here's a sample.
And Hika Maka Rakadakalola, and
home room
jester, and the trailer is Dola Rola Rola Rakadaka Molahola.
I think that's what I'll name my first child, Bob.
You can change your name.
There
right?
You go.
Couldn't have said it better myself.
In Los Angeles, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm Bob Moon. And for Steve Chiatakis, this is the Marketplace Midday Update.
And this is APM, American Public Media.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.